Production and distribution of City Club Forums on IdeaStream Public Media are made possible by PNC and the United Black Fund of Greater Cleveland Incorporated.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the City Club of Cleveland, where we are devoted to conversations of consequence that help democracy thrive. I'm Ayanna Blue Donald, Vice President of the Ohio Market at Enterprise Community Partners, a national housing nonprofit whose mission is to make home and community places of pride, power, and belonging. I'm pleased to introduce Sam Katz, co-producer and co-director of the documentary Gradually, Then Suddenly, The Bankruptcy of Detroit, which is screening at this year's Cleveland International Film Festival ahead of its official release on July 18th, 2024, the 11th anniversary, hard to believe, of Detroit's Chapter 9 filing. Sam Katz is no stranger to Cleveland. During his long career in municipal and project finance, Sam served as financial advisor to the Gateway Development Corporation of the City of Cleveland in Cuyahoga County and arranged the financing for what became known as Jacobs Field. Later, while serving as chair of the Fiscal Oversight Authority monitoring Philadelphia's finances, Sam started to pay attention to the tribulations of Detroit. He thought an important story was unfolding that needed to be documented through film. For 6 years, Sam and his colleagues worked on that film, which, while still in production, won the 2021 Library of Congress and Ken Burns Prize for Film. Gradually, Then Suddenly is the story of Detroit's monumental climb out of bankruptcy and toward a new era. When Sam approached my colleague, Melinda Clemens, who heads up Enterprise's office in Detroit, about sponsoring a showing here in Cleveland, it was an obvious choice for us. The film holds lessons that all American cities can learn from about fiscal responsibility, democracy, and the public, private, and philanthropic sectors, what roles they can actually play in the life of a city. Today's conversation with Sam will raise many important questions and ideas for the folks in this room, and I'm excited to get this dialogue going in this intimate group. If you have a question for our speaker, you can text it to 330-541-5794. That's 330-541-5794. And City Club staff will try to work it into the second half of the program. Members and friends of the City Club of Cleveland, please join me in welcoming Sam Katz. Thank you. Welcome.
It's the first time I've ever been at an event where you were asked to turn your cell phone on. Thank you, Ayanna, and thank you to all of you for being here today. And to the City Club for this invitation and to be in such a prestigious place with such a prestigious organization. I also want to just say how thrilled I have been with and excited about being part of the Cleveland International Film Festival, the operations and courtesy and hospitality of which have just been outstanding. A bit of personal bio. First of all, I grew up in Philadelphia. I live in Philadelphia. I'm a Philly guy. That usually generates boos. Certainly does in Philadelphia. For 35 years, I spent my career in municipal finance, project finance, and then venture capital finance, during which I made four races for public office and acquired a perfect record, 0-4. I ran for mayor of Philadelphia three times and governor of Pennsylvania once. In my first race in 1991, Philadelphia was going through a fiscal crisis. And I was a fiscal guy, so I thought I would interview for the job and I would get it. Didn't work out quite that way. In 2007, I decided to completely abandon politics and the pursuit of wealth in favor of something I knew absolutely nothing about, actually two things, filmmaking and history. I had seen documentaries about the histories of New York and Chicago, Las Vegas, New Orleans, Milwaukee, and went looking for the doc on Philadelphia's history, and there was none. So that was what I decided to prosecute. In 2010, the governor of Pennsylvania asked me to serve as chairman of the Fiscal Oversight Board that had been set up back in 1991 when I first ran for mayor. And almost immediately, I was seeing articles from the staff about trouble in Detroit. And I just really thought, because of the size of the unfunded pension liability, which Philadelphia was then confronting, something north of $5.5 billion, just to understand a pension liability question, if you know how much money you're going to have to spend over 20 or 30 years to pay a retiree, and you discount that to present value, meaning what do you need today to earn at X in order to pay that, and then you look at how much money you have in the bank, and the difference between those two numbers is the pension liability, the unfunded pension liability. And I thought we were on a pathway to bankruptcy. And then suddenly Detroit filed for bankruptcy in July 18th of 2013. And I was curious, you know, what is this going to look like? A year later, I got to understand that Detroit owned the Detroit Institute of Arts, its major art museum. I'm not just talking about the land or the building. I'm talking about the Bruegel and the Van Gogh, and many, many other pieces of art, the value of which was extraordinary, and which had been paid for with municipal resources back in the day, and that was even before back in the day, when the Detroit automobile industry was in its nascent but booming stages. Think $5 a day in Henry Ford. When I found out about the art museum, I decided this is going to be a great story. This has all the elements of class warfare, racism, suburbanization, the decline of the relationship between cities and their state capitals, and what a great story for a public finance guy to tell as a documentary film. I saw some challenges. I'm not from Detroit. I never did business in Detroit. I knew no one in Detroit. So that never stopped me from anything, unfortunately. I used to say when I started filmmaking that I really didn't know anything about what I was doing. And Connie, my wife, would say, and how was that different from politics? So I thought the first thing I needed to do was to earn the trust of the people who had been involved in the prosecution of the bankruptcy, the lawyers, the judges, the elected officials, the labor leaders, the pension fund leaders, the people who were retirees. And I spent 18 months getting to know the community and the people. The second big challenge is always finding the money. I work with lots of filmmakers today who want my advice, and I always have two questions. Who wants to watch it, and who wants to pay for it? I knew that the people in Detroit would want to watch it. I made a leap of faith that because of the importance of cities in the daily lives of Americans who live in cities and around cities, there would be an audience beyond simply the Detroit community. And the process was very interesting, both earning the trust as well as finding the money. Fast forward into the film's story, the bankruptcy of Detroit would still be bankrupt, but for the fact that foundations led by the Ford Foundation came to the rescue of the combination of the art museum and the pensioners and collectively provided $350 million. Ford, Knight, Kresge, Kellogg, the Community Foundation, all of these foundations were either bludgeoned into the mix or volunteered into the mix. There was a narrative that had been developed in the process of the bankruptcy which suggested that it was a grand bargain. And the words grand bargain took on a meaning in the Detroit bankruptcy that this was really a fabulous thing that had happened, not that the bankruptcy was, but the outcome, the exit from the bankruptcy, bringing in the foundations, moving the art museum out from under municipal ownership into a 501c3 status. All of this stuff, and then using the money from that transfer to fund the pensions of the city's employees and retirees. The third question I had, which I failed to confront immediately, was why would anybody want to watch a movie about a municipal bankruptcy? That never occurred to me. And so as a public finance person going in to tell a story about a municipal bankruptcy, I was telling a public finance story. And what I learned in the course of talking to people was that this was a human story, that there were significant human impacts on the people of Detroit who had seen a concept that I'd never heard of before. To be bankrupt, you have to be fiscally insolvent. The effects of being fiscally insolvent are that you quickly become service insolvent. You become incapable of getting a police officer to respond to a homicide. You become incapable of having a fire department show up to put out a fire before it burns the entire house or takes the entire block. You become incapable of delivering emergency services, of filling potholes, of having streetlights on, all of which had infected the city of Detroit. So how did that happen? How does the world's arguably the most important city other than Cleveland in the country, how does that happen? When you think about the core of the economy of Detroit, the automobile industry, it's the second most important industry probably behind housing. How does this incredibly robust, economically viable, vital, powerful community, a place where labor unions really got started, where social justice became a centerpiece, where some of the most important popular culture, Motown, emanates from, how does all of that happen? And so the answer to that question is lodged in the title of the film. It happens gradually. It doesn't happen overnight. 1950, Detroit is a city of 1.8 million people, 84% of whom are white, middle class, working. 2010, Detroit's population is 677,000 people, 84% of them are non-white, people of color. In the exodus that followed the policies of the Roosevelt administration, which set up the Federal Housing Agency, that mapped out every community where mortgages were going to be made and color-coded those maps, there was in every city there was a code called red, and that was redlining. And the FHA wouldn't make loans to any community, which even had a few African-American citizens living in it. So gradually you begin to see a housing crisis that suddenly emerges as a condition of desperation. You have a situation in which the GI Bill provides people with access to low-interest mortgages following World War II, but it also provides a ton of money through the Interstate Highway Act and other acts to build highways that enable people to leave their cities and go to suburban communities where they've gotten financing from the FHA. So in Detroit, what this created was a mass exodus of white people to suburban communities who didn't just not want to be in the city, they locked the door. There was no sign of anything resembling regionalism in Detroit. The best sign of regionalism is a regional transit system. And the automobile companies made sure there was not such a regional transit system, so you'd have to buy a car from them. So this gradual decline of the city, which probably started robustly after World War II, was exacerbated by the decline of the auto industry. In the film, which I hope some of you will see, I hope all of you will see, one of the commentators notes that there was a corporate oligopoly in the form of the big three manufacturers and a labor monopoly. And to quote him, he says, they were too busy fighting each other to notice that there were a few Toyotas coming down the road. So you can see that the automobile industry, which leaves Detroit, where there is vertical production, to get to more horizontal production with more land in the suburbs, without a transit system, making it very difficult for residents of the city of Detroit to get to the jobs that were in the suburbs, more gradually. So when Detroit's financial conditions started to deteriorate because the economic base was declining, The percentage of the population impoverished and in need of city services was increasing. The state was more and more alienated from the city, or the city from the state. Very Democrat, very progressive, in a state that was more middle of the road to conservative. There was revenue sharing, which helped prop up the economies of the budgets of cities around Michigan. Revenue sharing went away in 2008-09 during the crisis because Michigan, too, was suffering from the fiscal effects of the housing crisis. And in 2003, Wall Street sells to Detroit this great idea. We're going to sell $1,440,000,000 of pension bonds. We're going to put the money in the pension system, close the gap, and you'll pay debt service on that for 30 years. $800 million of that $1.4 billion of debt was done as floating rate debt, adjustable rate debt, floats. Those of you who have floating rate debt on your books, bad. In order to mitigate the risk of that float, the city entered into a series of what are called interest rate swaps. Now, this is an interesting part of the story. This is where the public finance guy conflicts with the filmmaker. I want to explain in the film what a swap is. I have to admit, I personally don't understand what it is, but I want you to understand it. And when I did that, and I did that on a number of subjects that were also complicated, the film was 3 hours and 15 minutes. And I sent the film to a woman who had been involved with the movie Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, which was an Academy Award nominated. It was very exciting to talk to somebody who'd been nominated to an Academy Award. And she said, look, I looked at your film. It's got some good stuff in it. It's way too long, and you're trying to explain things. I said, yeah, how do you hear about this stuff and not have them explained? She said, don't worry about explaining them. Just make sure people know they're bad. And I went back and watched Enron, Smartest Guys in the Room, which I hadn't watched in 10 years, and the story of how Enron took over the deregulated electricity market in California and then maneuvered and managed to control both the flow of electricity and its price for their own advantage seemed so complicated, and I'm a finance guy, I didn't understand it, but I knew it was bad. So that was a very important lesson. When you enter into a swap agreement, I see the eyes glazing over, don't worry, this is going to be very brief. When you enter into a swap agreement with a counterparty, if certain things happen, that agreement can be terminated. One of those things is a downgrade in your bond rating. Another thing would be the appointment of a receiver, an emergency manager, which is what happened in Detroit. And there were several other conditions. And you would then calculate what the present value of what would be owed by the party who was being terminated, i.e. the city of Detroit, that number came out to $350 million. For 3 years prior to the bankruptcy, in order to smooth out the arrangements of the swap, the city of Detroit paid UBS and Bank of America $50 million a year for three straight years. And then upon the appointment of the emergency manager and the downgrade of the city's bonds, the termination clause of the swap agreement was empowered, and now the city owed $350 million. Gradually, and then suddenly. And the suddenly was insolvency. The city had no money to pay $350 million. The city didn't have money to pay debt service. The city didn't have money to keep 40% of the streetlights on. It couldn't rehab vehicles. So there was an enormous backlog of emergency vehicles sitting in shops to be fixed. Fiscal insolvency, service insolvency. The gradual decline, an event that suddenly triggered bankruptcy. So the next component of the story I mentioned earlier is the emergence of the Detroit Institute of Arts. There are five museums in America that are the class of the encyclopedic museums, One of them is here. One of them is in Philadelphia. One of them is in New York. One of them is in Detroit. And I think the third is in LA, but I'm not sure. These are the museums that have everything. They're mini versions of the Louvre. This museum is a spectacular museum. And while it has many, many great things in it, it also has the Diego Rivera murals, which were painted by Diego Rivera at the behest of Edsel Ford. During the fear of communist era of our country. And Diego Rivera was a communist. And there was a lot of pressure on Edsel to take these murals down back in the period they were, I think they were done in the 40s or 50s. And the union stood up and said, no, you're not touching these murals, because the murals were about the people of Detroit who worked on the factory lines of the automotive industry. Okay, so here's a city with no money, owns its own art museum, has a $3.5 billion unfunded pension liability, has $5.5 million in unfunded medical liabilities, and another $8 or $9 billion of liabilities. It has about an $18 billion negative balance sheet. It's not a good look for anybody. But it had an asset. It had the art, it had the building, and it had the land. In a bankruptcy, creditors don't care about the continuity of the organization that filed for bankruptcy. In Chapter 11, a judge can break up a company, appoint a trustee, an executor, do anything they want to a company. Can't do that with Chapter 9. You can't do that with the municipality. These are governmental agencies. These are people who are elected. These are ongoing. They have to be ongoing concerns. When you come out of a Chapter 11, well, the company can be broken up. Who cares? Come out of a Chapter 9, you still have 677,000 people living in the city of Detroit. So a judge who was acting in the capacity as the mediator came up with this brilliant idea. We're going to invite the foundations to come and bring money to this project, to this problem. And they did bring a table full of foundation executives to Detroit and explained to them they needed $800 million. And I'm sure all the foundation executives were laughing. Somehow, they put something together, led by the Ford Foundation, which put up $125 million, with Kresge at 100 and Kellogg at 40, and gradually $350 million appeared, subject to a match by the state, and $100 million from the DIA. And suddenly, you have a corpus of the cash in the estate of the bankruptcy of about $816 million. And now there is a path to exit. So how much time have I consumed? Oh, not doing bad. I've been known to talk for hours, including to empty rooms. I should tell you, the very first time I ran for mayor of Philadelphia, really close friends of mine who were not politically astute said they were going to host a luncheon for me at their house. And when we got there, there were 85 folding chairs and 85 sandwiches. And about 10 minutes before the event started, there was no one there except Connie and me and the hosts. And then a lady showed up. She was the only one who showed up. I stood in front of her and gave her my speech. And I was telling your colleagues that the very first time I screened one of my films, I went to a church, an African-American church in South Philadelphia. The pastor had really promoted. I think he actually threatened his congregation that everybody had to be there. So I showed up in the basement of the church with a DVD, and they said, did you bring a television? Yeah, that was a really good conversation too. Anyway, so what I want to stop here for a minute and take time to show you, because we are getting to the end, is to go back to that third question that I mentioned at the outset, which is, how do you get an audience interested in a subject that fascinated you, but is not generally thought of as a general audience kind of subject? Connie, how would you like to go to a film about municipal bankruptcy tonight? Oh, Sam, I can't wait. So what I'd like to say is that what I am very, very conscious as a not... I'm not a a mission-driven filmmaker. So many filmmakers I know have great passion about something. I have passion about the city of Philadelphia, about its history, but all I want to do when I make a film is make it great. I try to make it great. That, to me, is most important. That's the only thing that matters. What is a metric that determines whether you made it great is really, how did the audience react to it? And how are they going to watch this? How are they going to think that they could even grasp this? So I came up with this idea that I would make the opening segment of the film feel like a whodunit, almost like a murder thing. So we're going to dim the lights, and then I'm going to take a poll. Did we succeed at making you want to watch this?
Buses will no longer be running around the clock. We're told service will be cut citywide.
City revealed its plans to lay off more than 160 firefighters.
So now with one fire station, they will have to cover 24 square miles.
EMS workers are facing layoffs. They insist there are not enough crews to respond to emergencies.
A vacant house turned into a dope
smashed through the front entrance of a Detroit grocery store and were gone long.
Detroiters ago. Really want to know, when will the streetlights be working?
91 at 7-Eleven, where people are voicing their opinions with yes or no.
On the city in crisis. Detroit bankruptcy could be days away.
Because it would be the largest Chapter 9 in U.S. history.
We had been reporting this story with a sense of looming inevitability. The writing was pretty much on the wall.
The story started to break on the morning of the 18th from the Free Press.
I said, Bill, we have to talk. We have received credible tips that the city of Detroit was preparing to file for bankruptcy. I needed him to confirm the story.
If you file that story, that will tip off every litigant against the city to go into court and get a TRO to stop the filing of the bankruptcy from occurring.
Once they file for bankruptcy, the bankruptcy code will trump the state constitution. You have now created the vehicle to cut the pensions.
In a sense, rewrite the book because it would be the largest Chapter 9.
We're in an office with every high-ranking editor of the Detroit Free Press, weighing in on whether or not we're going to run the story.
Nancy says, appreciate the honesty. Not going to hold the story.
On the city in crisis. Detroit bank leaders are dealing with protesters.
The police and fire board were going, you get up to Lansing this second.
Sources tell me that Kevin Orr will be filing a bankruptcy petition in federal court today.
Free Press is apparently unwilling to kill the story. But I'm hoping that the governor, who is very deliberative, hurries up and gives me the authority so we can file.
You're the governor of a state, a large state. You're a white Republican. The city about to teeter into bankruptcy is overwhelmingly Democrat and overwhelmingly African American. You're gonna think about that decision.
It was a hostile takeover. In Eastern Europe, they would call it a coup.
We finally get the letter, so we're all excited.
Can we file it? Can we file electronically?
Filing was so thick, it crashed the system.
The wheels start turning in Lansing in court. the litigants are trying to get before the judge. Our attorneys are trying to slow them down.
The Attorney General's office was representing the governor and the governor's people.
This was pretty fast-paced. I was on the phone with the Assistant Attorney General. You have to get to the courthouse.
We had gotten wind that pension fund of the city was going to try to stop the governor from authorizing the bankruptcy. I packed up the computer and raced over to the courthouse.
The plaintiffs brought before me a complaint that pensions were going to go into bankruptcy. This was so enormous. I just thought this was another attack on our Constitution, and I wasn't going to stand for it.
We got a hearing that's going to take place at any moment. When the judge walks in and brings the gavel down, it's over. We're not going to be able to get it done.
But I needed to hear the other side to say why there wasn't a violation of the law and the Constitution. The Attorney General needs 15 more minutes.
We refile immediately so that we can get in just before the hearing.
Said he was walking, said he would be late.
The Assistant Attorney General walked over to the courthouse, and he indicated he walked over as fast as he could.
Because we are all trained in the legal profession for civility. Let's be courteous.
I was sitting there on my laptop watching the federal bankruptcy website, refreshing this thing every few minutes.
There's rumblings in the back of the courtroom.
I looked down, and there was a filing. I turned to Ron King, and I said, "You guys are too late. They just filed bankruptcy." His immediate reaction was,
"Those fuckers."
We beat her by a couple minutes.
It had been basically played by the Attorney General's office, slow walking to the courthouse.
By the time he had gotten there, the bankruptcy had already been filed. And it was not due to some unethical delay that he slow walked.
I was courteous. They lied.
I was blissfully unaware of any collusion. It is what it is.
They're just bound and determined to run roughshod over any semblance of common courtesy, decorum, playing by the rules. There's no rules.
This is it. This is the city's chance to either reset the scales or the city's moving further down this spiral to obsolescence. And all of us knew that.
Just think how much money I could have saved if I had just made this a 6-minute film. Well, I take that applause as we succeeded, that you want to watch the rest of the movie. And that is when you are audience-centric in your thinking about filmmaking. You can be true to yourself, but you really do have to think very hard about what's it going to take, especially if you're dealing with a complex matter. What's it going to take to get people involved? So this we worked on for a long time. I can only tell you the first time that little girl was out on the street and we were filming her, I was shaking my head. It was an expensive day. We had a lot of crew. And I had no idea how we were going to use her. I didn't think we could use her. And she turned out to be the iconic symbol of the people of Detroit throughout the entire film. We would see her 2 or 3 more times. At the very end of the film, I don't want to spoil it for you, but she goes back to the bus stop, and we hear a bus coming. Unfortunately, we did not film a bus coming. So the film ends with her standing up and looking towards the bus, which hopefully is going to take her to school. Takeaways. When I started this, I thought we were going to do a film about the grand bargain, the foundations would come to the table, save the museum, the pensioners would get relief, the city would get 10 years of relief so it could invest in city services. I interviewed Ron King, who you saw, who represented the pension funds. He said it was a grand scam. When I heard the word grand scam, my mind said, okay, Sam, You're buying the narrative they're selling. Let's get underneath it and find out what really went on here. Second takeaway I have is the most discouraging thing. To have avoided what confronted Detroit by 2013, its elected officials would have to have made decisions that would have assured they would not be reelected. I want to say that again. To cut pensions, to cut employee wages, to cut services, to raise taxes, to do all the things that you might have done, which in some cases they did do, you would have assured yourselves of never being reelected. That's, as a politician, I can tell you that is not the way we think. That's not going to surprise anybody, I hope. But that really raises the question for me, how, given the complexity of problems that confront cities, states, and the nation, can we get decisions made by people who get elected who are only interested in getting elected? The third takeaway I have is that when you have a sense of superiority, when you are the world's leading manufacturer of automobiles, or you have the world's greatest economy, or you are the most culturally advanced nation in the world, you think of yourself as being special. You know, we have an American exceptionalism that sometimes translates to American superiority. And when you feel superior, any problem that you have, you come to believe will eventually work itself out. Therefore, you can kick the can down the road. Fourth comment I would make is that bankruptcy for municipalities is a last resort. It is the symbol of the complete breakdown of your ability to work anything out. Because what you are doing when you file bankruptcy in the United States as a city is you are borrowing the powers of the federal government to impair contracts that are protected in some cases, as was the case in Michigan, by the state constitution, which prohibited the impairment of pension contracts. Fifth, consequences of our decision. We make decisions without a lot of thought. They have 100-year implications. Whoever figured out what that cultural center that the film festival is going to be at was going to look like did a lot of long-term thinking. I've never seen a building which so reflected on the cultural importance of a place as this theater district. But all these decisions, whether they're debt or their construction, they have long-term implications. Debt is at the center of every financial crisis that this country or this or our cities have faced, and we have a problem dealing with them. To wit, the United States government has $34 trillion of debt and $77 trillion of unfunded Social Security and Medicare. And what we are going to do about that, I suspect, is nothing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sam Katz. We're about to begin the audience Q&A, and for our live stream audience or those just joining, I'm Dan Malthrop, Chief Executive here at the City Club. It's so good to have all of you here. By the way, Sam, like, I don't really understand what was going on, but I knew it was bad in your clip. Sam Katz is co-producer and co-director of the documentary Gradually, Then Suddenly, The Bankruptcy of Detroit, which is screening today, April 10th, just after this forum at 2:25 p.m. at the Mimi, Ohio Theater here in Playhouse Square as part of the Cleveland International Film Festival. You should go see it. We welcome questions from all of you, City Club members, guests, and those joining us via our live stream. If you'd like to text a question, you can text it to 330-541-5794. The number again is 330-541-5794, and we'll try to work it into the program. Let's have our first question, Meryl.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. My cousin grew up in Detroit, and so I talked to her about this movie and that you were going to be here. And she mentioned that the present mayor is looking at trying to restore some of those pensions that were lost. So my question is, when you do a movie like this, do you follow up and see what's happening, or do you kind of make the movie and say, okay, I'm done with it, let me move on?
Great question. First of all, I've never made a movie like this. This is the only movie like this I've ever made, because most of the movies I make are about history, and so everything I need to know already happened. I think when I went into this, I was intent on showing people that how this bankruptcy and the outcome of it made for a better future for Detroit. I was sort of thinking that was important. As I learned more about the present of Detroit, I was a little less sanguine about the future of Detroit. And I say that because it took 60 years gradually to go from a robust 1.8, 1.9 million person city to become a city that has streets with where 60 homes used to be, where there are one or two homes. You think about the efficiency of delivering municipal services. You got to run a sewer line down that street. You got to pick up trash on that street. The cops have to ride down that street. So you have a complete breakdown in the civic infrastructure. When we premiered the film in Detroit, and we did 10 screenings, I would say in every audience, at least half of them were retirees, police and fire, and non-uniform. And you would have thought that I was the cause of the bankruptcy. Because, pardon my French, I took a lot of SHIT for failing to recognize the incredible adverse impacts that this bankruptcy had on the retiree community. I decided that we were going to end the bankruptcy the day the judge gave the power to run the city back to the city. That was going to be the end of the film. Because at that point, you're now in a debate about whether it worked or not. And you're in the debate 4 years after the bankruptcy was over. And I've learned enough about history to know that history doesn't germinate in 4 years. Come back and see me in 40 years, when you can look back to 2013, 2014, and say, what did this mean? But I think the grief that we felt and the anger that we felt from people who were adversely affected by it stuck with me. And if I could do this all over again, I would probably produce a short, not another film, but a short, and maybe I will, in which the consequences of the bankruptcy, good and bad. I mean, there's a lot of things that were going good for Detroit. You know, everybody talks about the downtown and the midtown and all that stuff. And that you can't deny it. I see new buildings going up in downtown Cleveland. There's a couple of new buildings going up in downtown Detroit. There weren't any for many years. So I don't think we did what your cousin would have liked to have seen, but we didn't do it consciously. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm going to read one of the text questions that we've received. What are your thoughts about suburban apathy to Detroit during the gradual phase, but then sudden jump to help only when suburban families were impacted with the threat of Detroit's museum? What role should suburbs have in supporting the urban core?
Everybody heard the question? All right, so, having opinions about things, even if you think you know a lot about it, is always dangerous, especially when you're supposed to be objective. Having gone into dozens of cities over the course of my municipal finance career, I went to this project the same way I did that, including Cleveland, by the way. When I came to Cleveland as the financial advisor to the Gateway Economic Development Corporation, I met with Cleveland leaders, community, media. I saturated myself in the city of Cleveland, so that I'd understand something about the place. And I did the same thing in Detroit. What I saw in Detroit I had not seen anywhere, which was the extent of racism. I was stunned by the demographic change that occurred over 60 years, by the political isolation that had left Detroit, which once had 25 members in the state legislature, with 15. The mass incarceration that had occurred in Detroit resulted in people who were found guilty of crimes being located in state prisons around the state, and therefore being counted in the demography and electoral count in those counties. I saw a very successful, systematic stripping post Whitney Young of black power in Detroit. How intentional, nothing happens without intention. So that struck me as a really dangerous problem, really dangerous condition, and also a very serious concern for a filmmaker. Because I want people to understand what the implications of this are, but I am not saying, and I did not infer today, that what we learned in Detroit is applicable to Cleveland. I don't think it is. In fact, I would say that unless you own an art museum as a city, nothing that happened in Detroit is applicable. But the extent of the racial isolation of the people of Detroit was stunning, and it continues to be stunning. And in the absence of a truly system of justice, a system of equal opportunity, a recognition of the long-term impacts of continuing to allow, to use these words, but systemic racism, but I don't have a better phrase, I think it speaks to Detroit's probable limited future. I think unless and until, you have a whole generation of young African-Americans, particularly young people of color, who have, I have a very close friend who once said to me, Sam, everything you do, you start out believing you're going to be successful because you've been raised to believe you're going to be successful. And nothing that I do ever starts out with the notion that I'm going to be successful because I know I had no experience with success. You extrapolate that across the thousands of kids who live in cities today, and no matter what kind of self-help programs or efforts that are out there to make kids independent and smarter and all that, that underlying absence of expectation is devastating. And it's pretty apparent in all cities, Philadelphia included. Yes, ma'am.
You kind of answered my question, so I'm going to rephrase my question.
I'll make up a new answer to the next question.
Well, I think there's parallels with other cities. So population loss, FHA redlining, transportation system, which was inadequate, and then the swap thing. Out of all of those things, what was, and certainly systemic racism is the foundation, but what was the tipping point? And second question is, if they did have a TRO, would that have made a difference?
Let me do that one first.
Okay.
The underlying question that was often asked about all of this is that when the state took over the city of Detroit, it took over its mayoral and city council powers. It disempowered the mayor and city council. And that led to a belief that this had suspended or eliminated democracy. When in fact, the people who had decided to do that were elected by the same people who sent their representatives to Lansing. So there is a democratic state that had suspended the power of a democratic city. I say small d democratic. The problem is that the Constitution of the United States only recognizes one other form of sovereign government, and that is states. There's no reference in the Constitution to cities. Cities and counties and townships and boroughs and municipalities exist at the behest of states. So this is a two-edged sword. The state takes over the city that it gave authority to create and home rule because it wasn't ruling itself in the mind of the state properly, and then took over and used the federal bankruptcy code to impair contracts. On the other side of this question is the whole matter of how do you govern a place that has become ungovernable? And there are places like Detroit that had become ungovernable. So for them, the tipping point was the termination fee. This was not something that the creditors in bankruptcies, and one of the other things I should mention is that the lead bankruptcy attorney in this case was Jones Day from Cleveland. And the crowd from Cleveland and all of the other infrastructure of debt restructuring and bankruptcy are part of a corporate culture. And they're vultures. They come into a bankruptcy situation, and they immediately start to think about how do you tear the pieces apart so you can sell this asset and recapitalize that asset and go get rid of this management and put this management in. And that mindset was what was brought to Detroit. The same fellows and ladies who worked through the bankruptcy of Chrysler and General Motors were now back at the table ready to savage Detroit. And they wanted to sell art. That they were thrilled with the idea of selling art. It was really Kevin Orr who came to the realization that that was politically crazy. The suburbs wanted the art. The suburbs had passed a tax to fund the art museum. And it was a very suburban dominated board and philanthropic community that kept the Detroit Institute of Arts thriving. But it really wasn't a white person's museum, because the art museum had done a really good job of reaching out to the Detroit community to include them. But that's a matter of opinion. I would say the tipping point was the $350 million termination fee.
Good afternoon, and thank you for being here. I'm actually a mayor. I'm the mayor of Maple Heights.
Thank God.
And when I took when I became mayor in 2016, the city was in fiscal emergency. We were taken over by the Ohio State Auditor with a 5-year fiscal recovery plan. I'm not going into the details of that because you did a great job explaining my city. No street lights, not enough, barely 20 policemen, firefighters, and just really 5 people in the service department for 25,000 people. So my question is, Cuyahoga County has 59 communities. Do you believe that regionalization will save cities like Maple Heights? Thank you.
Well, obviously I don't know the details, and thank you for the question. So regionalization also is a two-edged sword. Yes, it brings to bear in a governing sense the power and the economics of the suburbs, which is always stronger than the city, but it dilutes the power of the people of the city, who tend to be people of color. So if you think about, well, you have a regional authority. We have one in Philadelphia called the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, in which all 5 counties each have 2 board members. Philadelphia has 1.6 million people. There's another 4 million people or so in the other 4 counties. But they have no interest, those counties, in the transportation of the old system that was in Philadelphia. And so for Philadelphia, SEPTA, which is what it's called, is really a troubled agency and not a successful one. Nashville-Davidson County is the best example that I know of successful metropolitan government. Maybe racial considerations there are not quite as acute as they would be in your community. But clearly, acquiring the economic base of wealthier communities is what's missing from cities. And so what's the trade-off? The trade-off is power. We have to give up a little power to get a little money. And isn't that what life is about? By the way, I should tell you that my company, it's called History Making Productions. My wife calls it Making Up History Productions. So.
Good afternoon again. Thank you so much. I would agree. The little girl was a good touch to the movie. So everybody watch out for the little girl in the movie. One comment and then one question. I think there are a lot of similarities between Cleveland and Detroit. I am a native Detroiter, born and raised, found my way to Cleveland. Smaller city, fairly similar demographics, state of housing stock, et cetera. And, you know, recently Cleveland has been named the worst city for Black women. And so the racial undertones here, they present a different way than Detroit, I would say, but just a ton of similarities having lived in both places. But I think one similarity also is just how resilient our community members are and the residents. And when you see the movie, you'll see just really how much the residents are prominently featured in the film and the advocacy that they did. And the same happens here in Cleveland as well when things happen. And so I'm also kind of curious, when you talked about kind of like the 5 things to watch out for, or the things to watch out for, like the residents and the community, like what was missed there? I mean, is it like electing the right people, right, to lead the city? Is it that somebody should have caught, right, the debt that was amassing or the problems that happened? I think a council person perhaps or a couple maybe saw this coming, as stated in the film. But what did the community miss, or, you know, what could have happened, should they have done along the way?
Well, I think cities like Cleveland and Detroit and Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and others, Buffalo, are places where grit is a central element of the DNA of the place. The nature of that grit is evident in the people of the city, and the fact that they survive in many instances conditions that a lot of us would be hard pressed to survive in. That grit, that resilience, as you referred to it, is not unique to Detroit. It's not unique to Philadelphia. We all think it is. And where that grit, and unfortunately, I think less so in culture and more so in sports, is evident is, you know, how our teams play and how we feel about our teams and how, you know, absolutely crazy we can get about our teams. Capturing the resilience of people who are impoverished. You know, Philadelphia right now, we have 357,000 people every day who are hungry. The level of understanding of that is virtually none. When you take a poor neighborhood, a neighborhood where poor people live, and you gentrify it, you are doing something that is historically traditional in cities. They're always renewing. They're always making themselves different. They're always trying to stay ahead of the curve. But in that process of gentrification, the problem that was visible becomes invisible because the people who were visible have been moved away from your sight. In our city, in North Philadelphia, Temple University was an African-American, largely poor neighborhood in which the centerpiece was Temple, is Temple. Now it's gentrifying. Where are those folks going? They're going further north. And for a lot of Philadelphians, they don't go further north, so they don't see that problem. And I think that the kind of leadership, you know, today, I ran as a Republican. I'm not a Republican anymore, but I ran as a Republican at a time when it wasn't a big deal to be a Republican and run for mayor of a city. It's hard. Registration edge was 7-1 Democrat. I lost by 1 point. Today, the political fracturing of the country and of the city and of places makes finding common ground on matters of poverty, social justice, that's woke. That's what they call it, woke. And I remember thinking the first time I heard that word, anybody who came through the last 5 years and didn't wake up, what the hell were they doing? And I think I'm optimistic about the younger generation, about, you know, I use the word diversity. In 75 years, what will the word diversity mean when we have all this commingling, intermarriage, whatever words you want to use? You know, I'm Jewish. I grew up in a family which the worst thing that could happen to you is that your child would marry somebody who was not Jewish. So I sent my children to Jewish day schools. My oldest daughter married a non-Jew. You know, and their kids are being raised with a diversity. They celebrate Christmas and Hanukkah. All of those kinds of changes, I think you can project a time in the future when the understanding that we seem to lack about each other is overwhelmed by the fact that we have become closer as people. And that's what gives me optimism. And the good news is I'm done.
Thanks so much, Sam, for joining us at the City Club today. Forums like this one are made possible thanks to generous support from individuals like all of you. You can learn more about how to become a guardian of free speech at cityclub.org. Our deep gratitude to Enterprise and the Cleveland International Film Festival for your partnership today, especially to Hazel Remish, who brought this film to our attention in the first place. And a reminder again that Sam's film, Gradually Then Suddenly, The Bankruptcy of Detroit, is screening in just a little bit, just a little over an hour. Next door at the Mimi, Ohio Theater at 2:25 p.m. Tickets are still available. Up next at the City Club on Friday, the Cleveland Foundation's African American Philanthropy Committee's biennial summit will join us. Jeff Johnson, Managing Director at Actum LLC, will lead a conversation with bank executives and entrepreneurs about philanthropy's role in economic stability and wealth building in the Black community. You can learn more about all of our upcoming forums at cityclub.org. And that brings us now officially to the end of our forum today. Thank you, members and friends of the City Club. Sam Katz, please ring the gong to adjourn our forum formally.
A premature ringing.
It was premature, yes. Thank you. Great job. Thank you.
For information on upcoming speakers or for podcasts of the City Club, go to cityclub.org.
Production and distribution of City Club forums on IdeaStream Public Media are made possible by PNC and the United Black Fund of Greater Cleveland Incorporated.